Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. Your hosts today are Dr. On, clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. I'm turning this over to you, Xander, to introduce our guest.
Thank you, On. So our guest today is Sam Dylan Finch. Sam is going to share with us what he learned after a near-death experience last year and how that experience branches into a lot of cascading realizations, such as coming into his identity as a man, repairing with his family, feeling more rooted in his queerness, and also coming back into community after a period of isolation. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So like many of our guests, we've known each other, right, for many years. We met when I was living in San Francisco and you were living probably in the East Bay, but I don't recall exactly when because I've lived in the Bay Area a couple of times. So I'm thinking it might have been somewhere around 2007, somewhere around 2012. I don't know if you remember.
I was here from 2014 to 2020. So,
okay. It was probably around 2014 then.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was trying to remember when exactly it was. My brain doesn't work so well. So we'll just jump right into the topic. So near-death experience. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about that. First off, let me just say thank you for wanting to share that story with us. And what would you like to share with us? What happened?
It's worth saying I've had some version of near-death experiences before related to attempting suicide, but this was in my adult life. And this is as much a story about grief as it is about a near-death experience. But I think walking through the timeline a little bit to help orient to what happened is probably the useful starting place, which is in September 2024, I had what tarot enthusiasts would call like a tower moment in my life, which is basically a spiritual everything must go sale, where I had decided to move to Minnesota. My best friend from high school, and I would call him my first love, Sean, had incurable brain cancer. And I just, you know, you have these gut feelings sometimes where you're like, I think we need to be closer. I'm in Portland, Oregon at this time, and I'd moved there mainly to be with an ex-partner who I was no longer with. I don't know how much time Sean has left, but I'm just going to move. No sooner did I sign a lease, put deposits down, arrange for this cross-state move, I lost my job. And I was like, you know what? Fine. I was just so determined to get to Minneapolis that nothing else really mattered. The other backdrop for this is that I had been mysteriously chronically ill for a few years at this point. I was just having all kinds of symptoms that seemed to be related to different parts of the body. And there was no cohesive theory at that time about what was going on with me. But what I knew at that time was that I was struggling to breathe. I was just not able to stand or walk for very long. I would just get pain. And I just had the sensation like blood was not going where it was supposed to. And this is the thing I kept repeating to my doctor at the time. I feel like blood is not getting to my head. I feel like blood is not getting to like my hands or my feet. It was a very strange feeling. But I made this cross-state move to Minneapolis. Sean's had to go through a lot of medical stuff. Maybe he can point me in the right direction. Unfortunately, he died 3 weeks after I got to Minneapolis. I did have the chance to say goodbye to him, but it was not the time that we wanted. And grief is a hell of a thing. And
yes,
instead of taking unemployment and grieving and just having my process, I said, let me start three businesses, which is a crazy thing to do. I was just like, no, if I stop, I'll fall apart. I can't possibly. Sean passed in November of 2024. So by the time we started to approach spring, something was horribly wrong. I was lucky to have a doctor at the time who, you know, it was like direct primary care model, so she could see me as many times as I needed to be seen, but virtually. She traveled a lot, and so this was long distance care, which is very limited. But even she got the sense something's really wrong here. My oxygen readings I started being my own guinea pig. So my oxygen readings were weird. I'd had elevated heart rate for 10 years that they never figured out. And I had an eating disorder history. And I just kept being told, when you recover from your eating disorder, your body will be fine. And it just seemed every time I went to eating disorder treatment, I got worse and not better. And so I'd say the big turning point was probably April 2025. I woke up one morning. I just had the weirdest feeling in the pit of my stomach. And then in my mind's eye, I had this flash where I saw this woman falling down, and she looked a lot like my dad's mother who died when he was 7. And I didn't really know much about her, and I wasn't really in touch with my family at this time. But I just had this quick flash, and then I just had this thought. It's not like I heard it in the room with me. It echoed in my mind of like, you're running out of time. The emotional feeling, it's like when you're standing on the edge of, I don't know, somewhere really high up. And you know you're fine, but you know one step and you would fall really far. It was that feeling of, oh, I'm in trouble. Something's wrong. But it was also accompanied with this calm feeling, deep, unsettling kind of calm. And I was living with a different ex at the time who, by that point, was just chosen family, who had moved in with me. We were both chronically ill, and we figured we'll just be two disabled people in one trench coat and try to adult our way through things. And they were walking down the hall at the time. They just saw I had this look on my face and they asked me what was wrong. I just looked at them. I said, I'm running out of time. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, I just know I'm running out of time. I just started rattling off instructions to them. I described this as the calm before a storm. I was like, I shouldn't sleep alone. Our beds should be in the same room. I started just rattling off these instructions. And they were bewildered because that was just not how I typically was. I was more so the person like outrun my feelings. And anxiety can't catch me if I'm always in motion. But for me to be doom preparing in this calm voice, they said they've never forgotten that moment. It was just so lucid. And not long after that, I started dying for real. And I stopped sleeping. Every time I tried to sleep, I would have heart arrhythmias that would just startle me back awake. My body couldn't shut down. I had all of this weird splotching on my face. My eyes turned yellow. I had ammonia breath. I started just swelling like a balloon. Belly was like hollow. You could like touch it and it would just echo in the weirdest ways. I knew I was in pain, but I couldn't figure out where I was in pain. Like, I just couldn't locate it. I kept collapsing. It was just all these things started happening all at once. In the course of a few weeks, we called 911 8 different times, went to the hospital 3 times, but pretty much every time, how they saw me was someone who is very verbal. I was trying to tell them as many body sensations as I could locate, thinking that I was giving them good information. But how they pretty much interpreted what was going on was, you're having a panic attack. Now, as someone who's worked in psychoeducation for a long time, I know what a panic attack is. A panic attack does not give you ammonia breath. You don't lose 11 pounds in one day. I honestly felt like I was going crazy with the amount of just nonchalance that kept happening when we would call 911. I think the big, I don't know how to describe it, epiphany at some point, it was the last 911 call that I made. I had managed to doze off for a minute, but when I woke up, I had this moment where I couldn't breathe. I started to doze off and then my breath stopped. And I kept waiting for my body to breathe again and it wasn't doing it. And then all of a sudden, I heard this hup sound in my chest. And then my heart, I felt it stop and then start up again. And that's not a panic attack, especially when I had been dozing off seconds before. We called 911 again. As I was laying in my bed trying to keep myself calm, I heard the EMT in the hallway say, "This house again. How many times are they going to call?" And I heard that. And I was so incensed that I went to stand up and confront them. I went from 0 to 90. I was so angry. I'm a scared person who is just trying to receive care. How dare you? In my home, in my home. And I went to stand up and I collapsed. I ended up breaking my glasses. I woke up bleeding with the EMT trying to take my blood sugar from my head wound. It was bizarre and weird. But I remember looking at him and I was just like, no one's going to help me. This is actually a lost cause. And I went from being angry to just being numb. I was just like, oh, no one's coming to help me. They asked me in this exasperated voice, do you want to go to the hospital again? And I just looked at him. I said, no. And he could just hear the resignation in my voice. So he tried to walk it back. He's like, we'll take you if you want to. It's just, you know, your blood pressure is high, but it's not like scary high. He's like trying to. I said, get out of my house. Please just leave. And what's odd is that initially I had that rage, but then I just settled into this. I realized that the amount of anguish was actually just depleting me and it wasn't even worth having the anguish anymore. But that evening, I had been tracking my vitals a lot and just trying to collect data. And for 6 hours, my heart rate was hovering between 130 and 160, just for 6 hours. I was just so stressed out of my mind. And I don't know what possessed me, but I had this moment where I think it's hurting me more to fight so hard to white knuckle and try to figure it out and try to understand. And all of this mental stuff that I was doing to wrap my head around what was happening wasn't changing it. My ex was sitting in the room with me. I just said, I think I need to let go. What do you mean by that? And I couldn't explain it. I just told him, I was like, I think I need to just let go. I had this feeling of if I stop white knuckling, I think my body might just die. I just had this strange feeling of, I think if I let go, I don't know if my body will, because I had been fighting so hard to just keep myself conscious and awake and okay. But there was just this intuitive knowing of like, I think I need to just let go. So I looked at Ray and I told him, I love you. Tell my family I love them. Tell my friends I love them. Tell my community I was so lucky. And I just had this thing where I was, I just need to accept that I might die and that's okay. There was this strange dual consciousness in it because I could remember being a young person who had attempted suicide several times, where a big chunk of my years as a child was just desperately not wanting to be here. And there was this profound irony that at the moment I most wanted to live, I was basically like, I think I just have to accept that that's not in my hands right now. And it never was. But then there was this flip side where I was, wait, I did it though. I wanted to heal from this trauma and I did because look at how hard I fought. And then there was the moment of maybe the trying was almost more painful than it needed to be. Maybe there was nothing wrong with me. I was just having all these realizations very fast. And then finally, I was like, I think it's okay. I had this moment. I really think it's okay. I became an adult who helped people, who had the privilege of walking people through really dark moments in their lives. I got to be loved by amazing people. I've come so far from where I was. And I just was like, okay, it's okay. It's actually fine. It's actually fine. And then I let go. I just let every single muscle in my body just let go. And I was wearing that monitor at the time so you can see what happened to my heart rate. Which is it went from being to being 60 beats per minute just for another 6 hours, where it was just me floating in that room, the calmest I'd ever felt, and being like, it's okay. It's actually fine. It's actually fine. And also with a little bit of cheekiness of, it was never really that serious, was it? We were so lucky to be here. It was just this odd moment of, yeah, it's okay. But then the sun came up again and I got another day. Wait, I get to keep doing this. And actually, I think I need to keep letting go. I think I'm trying too hard. I think I'm driving myself crazy trying too hard. And so I got this mischief in this process where I was just like, well, okay, if the EMTs are not going to help, that's okay. What was all of this nervous system education I did for if not for this? And I also started thinking about when I was a teenager, Sean, my friend who passed away, he sent me this short story by Amy Hempel. It's called The Man in Bogota. And basically, the narrator sees someone on a bridge who is threatening to jump. And the narrator is thinking about what she would say to this person who's about to jump. Talks about this man who was kidnapped, who was held for ransom. And for 3 months, his kidnappers had to keep him alive in order to get the ransom. So they basically forced him to eat healthy and take care of his body and all this stuff. The narrator says, I know this isn't like a come down from the ledge story, right? Kidnapping's not good. But when this man went to the doctor after he was released, the doctor was like, you're in the best shape of your life. And so the last line of the story, which I literally have tattooed, is he wondered how we know that what happens to us isn't good. And I woke up. I mean, I didn't sleep that whole night, but the sun came up and I was just, how do I know? How do I know that I'm not prepared to face this? How do I know? How do I know that 10 years of tachycardia didn't make my heart really strong? Maybe I'm basically a marathon athlete and I don't even know it. I just had this playfully delusional attitude of, okay, if they're not coming to save me, why can't I do this? Or die trying, I don't know. So I just completely flipped what I was doing. I'm going to listen to all my favorite songs. I'm going to dance when I can dance. I'm going to drink as much water as I can. I was doing like my own lymphatic drainage. I'm just going to try everything. Who says I'm not smart enough? Who says I'm not strong enough? Who says I'm not capable enough? I realized every day after this is a gift. Every day before it was, I just didn't know it. And so I was already loosely in contact with my family. When I thought I was dying, I had reached out to them. I can't even say what possessed me, except I just was like, if I have no time left, I would regret not trying to repair that. I think also just being that sick made me realize like no one gets out of this alive. No one has an easy life. Suffering is a part of the human condition. We're all just permutations and a lot of it is luck. And I just had this perspective of as much as my parents let me down, there was love inside all of it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be so pissed off. And so I started to call them more regularly. And what was really wild and strangely moving is that even friends who had known me for years didn't notice that my eyes were yellow. I didn't notice my eyes were yellow. The EMTs didn't notice my eyes were yellow. But when I called my mom, she said, "Why are your eyes yellow? You haven't seen me in years." And that's the first thing you notice. And so I just started to have this moment of love is really complicated, isn't it? As a trauma survivor, I was like, if I just get this formula right, I will surround myself with people who can't hurt me. If I know all the red flags and all the signs, I will just arrange my life so that I never get hurt again. But what that really looked like was becoming agoraphobic, not trusting people, not having real intimacy, and then going online and talking about my most intimate inner world and being, well, you chose to be here. So, AKA not taking the emotional risk of offering this to people in my real life, just giving them the spark notes after I had the emotion, which is not the same as intimacy. And so I just all of a sudden was like, I have to change everything about my life while I still have the chance to do it. And at this point, we still don't fully know what's going on medically, but my doctor was treating it like mast cell activation syndrome. We were basically just assuming maybe a cytokine storm or my immune system is going bonkers. And that was our best guess. But at this point, all we know is that joy maxing, as I was doing at this time, and reaching out to family and just otherwise having the perspective of like, I'm going to follow every glimmer or die trying, was doing something. I started writing poems again. I started writing songs again. And then eventually I made the very wild choice to go move in with my parents, which we had been estranged for 2 years and low contact for 10. We were basically strangers to each other at this point. But I was like, if I can get through whatever the hell that was, then I can go hang out with my parents. Within a month of being at my parents', my health started to torpedo again. So it was back in the hospital. And I had this funny moment where I was so deliriously happy. I've forgiven my parents, which my parents were even confused by. I mean, everybody around me was like, you just seem deliriously happy. I am. Because I think it just does something to you when you realize I was dead long before this happened. I was living my life in the shape of my fear, isolated, not really asking myself what I wanted. I was just in survival mode. And there was a strange blessing in realizing I can just choose to not live that way anymore. I could just choose that, which is not to say it's easy. But at that point, I was like, I don't think I have anything to lose at this point. But I went to the ER and I made the decision, I'm going to let them do their job. I'm not going to tell them, here's 50 symptoms I've had. Here's my medical hit. Just let them do their job. And literally the nurse looks at me and then touches my body, takes my blood and walks out of the room. Then she comes back and she's whispering. And I'm like, oh, she's like, we're going to put you on 3 antibiotics and give you something a little bit stronger than morphine and you're being admitted. And I was like, oh, great. And at this point, I don't know what's going on, but that sounds nice. At least you're doing something. Well, come to find out, my gallbladder had ruptured months prior. Somehow it walled off the infection. But the night when I felt colder than I'd ever felt in my life and the fact that I wasn't sleeping and all that, that was septic shock. And it is actually wild that that did not kill me. And it's wild that I was dancing and walking around and calling everybody and just living while my body was trying to do this very extraordinarily hard thing. They weren't able to operate initially because my liver was really struggling, understandably, but eventually they were able to remove the gallbladder and it was necrosed and in horrible shape and had been that way for at least several years. And I knew when it was removed, I was like, my life is about to drastically change. But the secret was out. I can thrive even on the edge of death, which means there's a lot more I can do that I didn't understand that I could. And it changed everything. Yeah.
That's wild. I had a very similar experience.
You did?
Oh, I did. Yeah. I'm very critical of our medical system.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bias and it harms people, gets in the way of being able to assess accurately. But foremost, people aren't listening because they've already formulated their opinions.
Yes.
And they base it on what they know, not on the possibility of what they don't know.
Yeah.
And my own personal experiences have completely reshaped who I am as a nurse, but as a human being. So I had a gallbladder that was on the verge of rupturing.
Yeah.
My lungs then filled up with fluid. Yeah. I signed out AMA because of the attitudes. Nobody was listening.
Yes.
And then I was with my late husband at the time, and then he had to return me to the ER, where the radiologist told me, had I not been a runner in previous years, I would have drowned. There was so
Yeah.
much fluid in my lungs. And that's what spared me, was the fact that I had been a long distance runner. And so I had long, lengthy lobes that could absorb all that fluid. Had I been anybody else, I would have drowned and not
Yeah.
made it. I am so sorry that you had this experience
Yeah.
because you dealt with judgment. Anybody who's experienced whatever is behind judgment loses trust. And then you have to, if you're kind to yourself and kind to others, you have to rebuild that trust. And that doesn't happen overnight.
No, it does not. Yeah.
I'm glad you're alive and you're able to tell this story. We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keag, and our guest is Sam Dylan Finch. Sam talks about life after death and how that experience branched into a lot of cascading realizations. Let's take our first commercial break. We are always grateful to our sponsors and therefore grateful to play their commercials. Don't go away. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased. Naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keag. Our guest this hour is Sam Dylan Finch. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, it's strange to tell people the worst thing that ever happened to me was the best thing that ever happened to me, but it is both deeply, truly.
Well, it's a very compelling story, right? It's not just that you tell it well, which is might be a strange thing to say, but I think it matters in how much detail you give. And it was very descriptive. I felt like I was not just listening to you tell a story. It was almost as if I was traveling with you through it. It was really pulled me in. So I appreciated that. And I don't have that experience. As far as I know, my gallbladder is doing all right, but I've had my share of interactions in medical settings. Starting as young as, I mean, when I was born 2 months premature and put in an incubator. And so my life started out with medical trauma, or as we might call it. When I was 6 years old, I had the MMR vaccination and contracted rubella and ended up getting encephalitis and being put into a medical induced coma for 2 weeks. And when they brought me out, I was paralyzed. And I, interestingly enough, I don't have a visual memory of this because I don't have visualization, but I have a sensory memory of, and then partly stories that my parents told me of being, I was in the hospital for about 3 months at a neurological institute outside of Phoenix, Arizona. So I was paralyzed on the whole left side of my body when they brought me out of the coma. And I needed to use the restroom. And I'm not exactly sure why, but the nurse that was tending to me, when I said I needed to go to the bathroom, she said something along the lines of, well, then go to the bathroom, meaning get up and go. But I was paralyzed. So I'm like, maybe she doesn't know that. So, but my 6-year-old obstinate self, I basically threw myself out of the bed and was GI crawling, you know, maybe one arm, one leg to the bathroom. But then she saw me and was mortified because maybe she realized or somebody said something, but I was fine. But I'll just throw myself out of bed and I'll get myself to that damn toilet. And I remember my parents telling me a few years later that the doctors, there was a whole group of us that were actually in the hospital at the same time with the same issue, very different presentations, but we all had the MMR vaccination. There was something wrong with the batch. But the doctor told my parents that not only was I doing better than all the other kids, that I was probably going to be okay. And he said that the only thing he can think of for the reason why is because of that obstinance.
Yeah.
It's really what he told them. It's like, it's what kept me alive because I was the most engaged in the physical therapy and the occupational therapy because there was a part of me that you just watch. You tell me I'll never walk again. I'll never do this again. Watch me. Right. So that obstinance is what really, right. So in your case, it was a surrendering.
Yeah. There were definitely moments, especially after EMT call number 8, I was just like, watch me then.
Mm-hmm.
But it did require that surrender piece too. It was a back and forth. It was a seesaw. I had moments where I definitely had to get up and go. I mean, I had barely walked in 3 years and I knew I was retaining so much fluid. I mean, this happened a year ago and I've lost 100 pounds since then. And a lot of that was within the first few months. I mean, it was rapid, worryingly so. But there were a lot of moments where I didn't know exactly medically what was going on, but I noticed, you know, the first time I had lived in the Bay, I took a self-massage class where we learned myofascial release and lymphatic drainage and to do it on ourselves. And I just had this nudge where I was like, well, if this is fluid, which it seems like it, can I move it? Like, can I keep it away from brain and heart? Can I just kind of do that? And so there were nights where I wasn't sleeping anyway. So I was just drinking water, using the massage balls to push the fluid. And then Ray would put me in this wheelie office chair and we'd drag me to the bathroom. And then because at the time my organs were not doing well, I would just pee standing up in the shower and just let gravity kind of help. And when I talked to my doctor later, she was like, you were your ICU care. Not that that's exactly what they would have done, but you were trying to move that fluid and to keep things doing what they were supposed to be doing. She was like, your intuition was spot on. That was probably the better thing for you to be doing. And that for me, especially as someone in eating disorder recovery, which I have so many question marks now. If my GI system has been busted the whole time, was the anorexia compensatory? Was it restriction to protect my body? I'll never know. But because of that history, you know, I worked really hard, especially in the last 5 years, to develop a really trusted relationship with my body. And I do think that's part of what saved my life. I don't think anything my body is telling me is random. I don't have a reason to think my body's doing this for fun or to scare me. This is not like a haunted house body. Things are happening and my body's on my side. So we're going to three-legged race through this. And I do think that was part of it too, that surrendering I could do. Because I knew my body was holding me, even if my mind wasn't always there. And it certainly wasn't, because there were definite moments of like full delirium where I was like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm not home. But yeah, part of that surrender was just that deep relationship with my body where I was just, and a lot of it, you know, I think was a deconstruction process too, because I'd been in the mental health system for so long and I had to break so many rules. There were points where my body was like, don't eat. And of course, anyone on my care team at the time would have been very alarmed by that. But I just felt so strongly. There were windows of time where I think I'm just supposed to drink water and wait for a second. Which again, knowing now that the gallbladder had tore makes total sense. But it was one of those things where I realized something about myself in the process of the EMTs, like not supporting me, a lesson that I'm very grateful for, which is that, you know, as a trauma survivor and someone who'd been in the mental health system for so long, I was so used to handing my power over, deferring to authority, assuming that somebody knew better than I did. And I'd done this throughout my life. And I finally got to a point, I was like, they clearly don't know better than I do. They think this is a panic attack and that's stupid. And I just got to a point where I was like, okay, well then, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I'm a former journalist. I have enough signals from my body to know symptom by symptom what's feeling better and what's feeling worse. And I worked with my doctor at the time, which I'm very grateful for. And she was terrified. She told me later, she's like, I was not sleeping. I knew something was wrong. But as a doctor, there was only so many things I could do. Tell you to go to the hospital and pray, really, was what I could do. But I would tell her, this is how I'm doing the lymphatic drainage, or I would basically consult with her. Is this medically indicated for what we know? And of course, we didn't know much, but I was very grateful because it was the first time I'd had a medical professional who trusted me and saw me as competent. And that was extremely meaningful because all I could do in that condition was trust myself enough to keep doing the things that provided some amount of relief and hope that my body could carry me to the point where I finally got the right care. But it is wild to think that that decline started in April. I didn't get surgery until close to the end of October. So when I say near-death experience, that was an altered state for months. And, you know, it's one of those experiences where you look back and you're like, I don't know how the hell I did that. The screaming, yeah. Crying throw up is how I did
that. I mean, the body is miraculous in that it walled off. That probably saved your life.
Yes. And it's one of the paradoxes of being chronically ill. It's like, I think my body was accustomed to having a high heart rate and having low grade infection and all of these things going on. It could do that. And I think I'm very interested in chronically ill subculture online. And I think there is a lot of conversation about what it means to be chronically ill. And I think I internalized some ideas that it meant I was more fragile and that I was able to handle less. When COVID happened, I became very agoraphobic. I don't think my body can take anymore. But in that experience, it challenged my thinking. Maybe my body is resilient, and chronically ill and resilient do not have to exist in different buckets. Maybe they're exactly the same bucket. And that, on top of just realizing that all of the stuff that I'd learned about the nervous system and supporting my mental health and being neurodivergent and making a life that met me where I was, those were perfect skills for that moment. Because the one thing that I'm grateful for that did not really enter my psyche at that time was shame. I was so grateful that I'd done enough work within myself to see how those EMTs treated me and be sad for them. Wow, to have that level of compassion fatigue, to have that level of inability to meet me human to human. Thank God I'm not you. It was just like what I kept feeling in my heart. I was like, thank God. And when they sent me a survey in the mail, like, how'd we do? And I just wrote this letter of, I don't know if you need to pay them more. I don't know if they need more vacations. I don't know. Obviously, it's a systemic thing, right? Whatever you need to do to take care of the people I interacted with, something's wrong. And I do think too, because I was in a larger body at the time, I was almost 300 pounds by that point. A lot of it we now know is retained fluid from just years of dealing with this. But I remember one of the EMTs telling me, well, you look healthy. And it's crazy. If you look at photos of me at that time, no one would have thought that. But I think what he saw was someone in a larger body that was talking. And I think the combination of me being very verbal and being in a larger body and generally someone who hides pain well, because I mean, you can only go through so much trauma and not learn how to adapt that way. But yeah, I think like you were saying, there's just a preloaded assumptions that arrive very, very quickly that don't allow them to meet you in that moment. And for me, what I took out of the emotional pieces of that was just how lucky I was to still be soft-hearted in a world that does so much to make sure we don't retain that. And to be soft-hearted enough to moving with my parents and to have already forgiven them before I even arrived. One thing I know for sure, when I came back from the edge of death, I'm not bringing hatred with me. There's enough of it already. I won't do it. It's not who I am. It's not me. And for all of the things that were truly awful about what I experienced as a young person, I understand in a deeper way than I think I ever have that love changes us. And so every time I encounter someone who does not meet me in the ways that I deserve to be met, I think about the love that I've received in my life that allowed me to stay soft, and I only have gratitude. Whatever I need to do to protect that part of me is what I will do for the rest of my life. I think the original question of what would you like to tell us, that's the whole thing. In a world that does such a good job of making us mistrust our bodies and ourselves, handing over our power constantly, waiting for somebody else or someone else to fix it or make it better. I think part of what I was surprised to find was that stepping into my power meant surrendering to my softness. Those are identical. Those are the same. And I think that's why so much has changed and so much has become clearer too. I mean, as like a chronic overthinker, I really thought I was cooking for a while with how many stories I had about myself. But I think the strange miracle about both surviving the near-death experience and then finding out I'd likely been chronically ill my whole life, I don't know what's possible and I don't know what's true, because so much of the mental health narratives I had about being neurodivergent or which diagnoses or which traumas, I had all this scaffolding that was meant to give me a blueprint for who I was and what I could and couldn't do. That just got thrown in the fireplace. I was like, I actually don't know. And even now, when I started seeing a therapist again, he was like, I cannot diagnose you right now. Not only because you went through this very traumatic thing, but you now have post-sepsis syndrome. And so we don't know if your mood swings are just you in recovery or if they'll persist or not. And I think that's the other thing that's been a gift, is just deconstructing everything I knew about myself and throwing it away. The things that remain true in that near-death experience are how much I love the world and people for all of the ugly parts of the experience. I'm glad for it. And then I know that part of what kept me alive was just this friendship with Sean when we were teenagers. We were sending each other poems and music, and just we were remembering what it really means to be alive. Like, capital A alive is like what I would call it. And I know that part of what got me through that experience too was just tapping into that. And it made me realize what it really means to be on autopilot in this world is to be disconnected from what makes us feel alive. And I do think it is so important, especially now, that wherever possible, we move toward aliveness, which is inherently risky and courageous and counterculture, I would say, at this point. But I absolutely do think that I would not still be here if I hadn't been writing the poems and remembering what I loved about being alive and remembering the people who taught me that and who loved me so well. I mean, one of the things that was just so incredible about Sean as a friend, which I think is something we could all learn something from, is that when he was speaking to me when I was on my own ledge, ready to jump, it was not the sort of like hedging that I think a lot of my therapy speak friends, bless them, do, where they validate your emotions for like 5 minutes. We're like, yeah, things are hard and you lost your job and this is really difficult. And I know that, like, as a marginalized person, I'm like, okay. Sean would have just told you, you're going to be okay. I know you are. I know your heart. I know who you are, and you'll get through this. And it was a convicted kind of love that I had to channel through that near-death experience, where it's like, I need to love myself with conviction to get through this. And now I think that's a big part of it too, is I just want to be convicted in how I love people and how I live my life. 10 toes on the ground kind of thing. And that's how the repair happened. And okay, actually, I'm just a man and I'm going to have to get rid of the hangups I have about that. It just, once I had that convicted kind of love of self and that aliveness, I was like, oh, I have no idea what the future is going to look like, but I know it's going to be amazing because I'll be doing it truthfully, wholeheartedly. The thing I've been telling my friends is, and this means a lot to me as a suicide attempt survivor, I'm going to let life kill me in all the ways, get my heart broken a million times, travel, love people well, love people recklessly even, but like, let life kill me this time. And I can say pretty confidently that something happened in that surrendering. I will never take my own life. I could never. It's the strangest thing. And I had already been approaching that place in my healing anyway, but it just closed the door. It's actually a privilege and an honor to let life kill me, to let that happen, to let that go. Yeah.
I wanted to mention, because we do have listeners from all over the world, that people who do have panic attacks don't have them just because they're highly anxious people. You remove the cause, a lot of times the panic goes away.
Yes.
And I think it's important for people to hear that.
Yes.
You remove the cause, the panic goes away, whether it's physiological, mental, whatever it is. Remove that cause, panic will go away.
Yeah.
Instead of band-aiding the panic, treating the panic, doing that human being a service and getting behind what may be triggering that panic.
Yes.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kay. Our guest is Sam Dylan Finch. Sam is sharing with us what he learned after a near-death experience. We are always grateful to play our sponsor's commercial. Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this commercial.
UK House Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment, we explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Let's get back to the show.
I mean, that was the wild thing too when the EMTs were telling me it was a panic attack where I was, yeah, that's information for you. That doesn't rule out anything medical at all. It would be reasonable to have a panic attack if you're dying. It would be completely reasonable. And I think that was a part of what was just so devastating about the whole thing. My body's giving me very clear information, and a panic attack is very clear information. And I've had them before, and it was always a signal of something has to change. It's the stop sign appearing. Hold on. It's the emergency brake. And I think that was part of what was just so heavy in that moment. What's your point? Even if it were a panic attack, you still need to treat me like a person and you still need to do your job. And generally speaking, I think it's better to err on the side of just trusting that people know their bodies and know themselves. And as much as I have grief over how all of that unfolded, I also know that I wouldn't have reached the place of real sovereignty in my own life if it had been a story of somebody else saving me. I think it had to go this way, as painful as it was. Because I think one of my deep fears as a trauma survivor, especially, something bad's going to happen and no one's going to be there to help me, which that's what happened. And then I had this fear of I'm going to have something terrible happen. I'm going to be alone. And that's essentially what happened. And I think once you face your biggest fears, it just the whole world opens up. And I spent all this time afterward just doing everything that scared me to just there was a thrill in it all of a sudden. I went on my first really big roller coaster and I was like, wow, I would have never. I feel like I'm meeting myself for the first time every time I do something I thought I couldn't do.
It's like that old book title said, feel the fear and do it anyway.
Yeah. Right?
Which I remember my father had that when I was younger, right? It's sort of a motto that I was raised around. I'm not a risk taker in the sense of I'm not going to bungee jump off the bridge or skydive. Like, that's just not my thing. But I'm so grateful for having parents. They were divorced when I was 2. So I spent more time with my dad than my mom. But they were both risk takers in ways that were different, but showed me that it was okay to do that, to be the only person that maybe said something about something when everybody else was going along or too afraid to say anything. I remember when I was 17 years old, I dropped out of high school, rented a U-Haul, and drove from Los Angeles to Salt Lake City to start my life. That's a bit dumb, but also pretty gutsy, right? So it was for a girl, you know? That was probably not the smartest thing. I mean, talk about a high school dropout. I had to get a job and start paying rent. I mean, I had no skills for that. Nothing had prepared me for that. I had been getting an allowance for like $20 a week from my dad. You know what I mean? Like, I was just some upper middle class kid. I didn't know how to have a job and start paying rent and buying groceries. I had never had to do that. Well, I was 17, but still. So there's something about that chutzpah, you know, to like just, I like to call it moxie. I think my default is to just have that tenacity. Again, I'm just reflecting back on your story and it's really moving. You touched on several of the pieces that I mentioned in the introduction, except you did just a small little amount on the being a man, which I think is interesting because we're all trans men, right? So there's something different about that. I don't know about you, but I haven't internalized, but I've definitely noticed that there can be a lot of anti-male sentiment within trans or maybe even the queer community, which I don't personally participate in much. I'm sort of an LGBT person than a Q person. And then the other thing is where don't have as much time for this, but if there's something you want to say about also the isolation that you had experienced previously and coming back to community, and maybe there's some overlap there.
I mean, they were one in the same process, I think. So when COVID happened, I became very agoraphobic, which I want to be clear, some amount of COVID cautiousness, depending on your situation, makes sense. So I'm definitely not knocking that. And I had good reason to think that my health wasn't in a good place. So having some amount of cautiousness made sense. But I think what I didn't fully notice was how small I was making my life. And in doing that, I wasn't seeing people. I wasn't in community anymore. I wasn't interacting with people as much. And I lost myself in a very big way. And of course, like medically, there was a lot going on. I mean, I've been shocked by how much cognition has come back online since surgery. That's been really shocking for me. But I think one of the things I started to realize was just this pattern in my life. This do without pattern, where I was like, if I can survive, then I don't need it. I did that with testosterone, where I was like, well, Trump was reelected. Maybe I just need to get used to a future where I don't have HRT and I don't need it that much. And just so much rationalizing away of what I wanted, even if I didn't quote unquote need it. And not understanding that wants and needs aren't really remarkably different, in my opinion. But I started bargaining away connections with people, gender affirming care. I just started discarding things. I was definitely in survival mode. Some of that sentiment that you're talking about, I mean, I held that in part because I had experienced a lot of harm at the hands of cis men, substantially so. I hadn't realized the ways in which I equated manhood with violence. The idea of being a man to me was to walk towards something that deeply scared me, that I did not want to be. Even though I knew logically, gender is a social construction and it is what you make it, and you can be whatever kind of man you want to be. All of that's well and good, but until you do the deeper healing around it, I tap danced away from being a man and toward it so many times. But I think what was remarkable was when I was dying, I was the most in my body I'd ever been. And I had this moment of, what the hell am I doing? Why am I not on testosterone? Why am I turning my gender into a dissertation instead of something that just is in my heart and on my heart? I mostly identify as a gay man now. I think that was also really scary. Wait, I have to be in close, intimate relationship with men. What? And when I repaired with my dad and just started to notice, I'm originally from the Detroit area. So when I went back to my hometown, I'm from a big Maltese immigrant family, and just being around people, I was mirrored again.
Well, thank you, Sam.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. This is great.
Thank you, Sam. You've been listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg and our guest, Sam Dylan Finch. Until next time, thank you for listening.